This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars sponsored by WEPA. Join NITP for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to the August 17th, 2020 For Your Benefit radio show. Today we're going to talk about keeping your financial and estate plan on track during the pandemic. And who best to lead us in that discussion is Karen Schaefer, Certified Financial Planner. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning, Bob.
And Megan Schaefer, Estate Planning Attorney. Good morning, Megan.
Good morning to you, Bob.
Well, it's good to be here. It's been a while since the three of us have been together, and I still remember how good the prior ones were, so I'm sure today will be every bit as good or better. So I'd take the thousand-mile view maybe here. What everyone should know about the CARES Act. And that's a quote. Why do I need to know everything?
Well, exactly right. You don't need to know everything, but you do need to know that these tax laws that we've been getting, you know, they seem to be coming out. There'll be another one, it sounds like, pretty soon. Are giving people the impression that they have an action item when actually they really just need to understand, yes, there's legislation going out, yes, the intention of the legislation is to help everybody, but if you've got a pretty good financial plan in order, it may just be something that you, a data point that you don't need to file for easy recall. So, you know how this CARES Act actually worked. It gave some people some immediate money. But what it really did was give a lot of people access to retirement money. So all of a sudden, you could be taking money out of your 401k or thrift savings plan without a penalty, no matter how old you were. And if you did have to pay the tax, of course, you have to pay the tax if it's coming out of a traditional account. You could pay it back over 3 years, or you could take bigger loans than ever. And, you know, on the one hand, you read that and go, oh, thank goodness, we've got access to money. And it's really, for most people, a bad idea. I don't know how many people have been asking you, Bob, but the people who are asking us, we've always found a better way for them to get through what I hope is a financial speed bump, not a financial disaster, known as the 2020 pandemic. And you start taking money out of these retirement plans, for the rest of your life, you will be likely facing a lower standard of living, certainly a less attractive retirement, because the money comes out, you don't put it back, and you lose all the money that you had to pay taxes on.
Do you, when you provide tutelage to somebody asking you that question, they say, well, I'm not going to take a lot out. Now, I don't know the definition of a lot. It's going to certainly vary with each person. And I'm pretty good investing, and I'll make it back. What's your response to that one, I can imagine?
Look, investing has enough what-ifs and unknowns and can't predict consequences. We don't need to add a loan to the mix. That's sort of the same question we used to get. Shouldn't I be borrowing money against my house and investing it? And I'd always give the example of the person who took out $100,000 in the year 2000. Because remember back in the day, Bob, you're old enough, Megan, maybe not. the market was irrationally exuberant. How can you go wrong? We'll take out $100,000 and we'll invest, and you make double digits all the time. And then what did the market do? In 2000, down 10%, then in 2001, down 11%, then in 2002, down over 23%, for the love of God, right? Here we're making payments on a $100,000 home equity line of credit or refinance, and we've got about $70,000, you know, maybe even less in the market anymore. It took forever for that to make sense. So I can afford market volatility. But if I've got a long view, but I can't afford it if I have a debt to pay. And that's the problem with that logic.
What about the ones that call you up when the market took a hit more frequently than not and they want to pull the rest of the money out or switch it from, say, the C fund type investment to a G fund type investment. What was what was your feeling with that?
Well, you know, first of all, compassion, right? Let's be real. We're human beings, and even though intellectually we all understand that the smart investor buys at a low price and sells at a higher price, when the market drops and the value of my account drops along with it, it's not exactly like I can say, okay, what do you want to have for lunch today, Bob? You know, it's really painful. So part of it is understanding that that fear and that panic is sort of an ingrained human nature survival, we can't help ourselves, almost knee-jerk reaction, and then you face it. Okay, you're okay, though. You have enough money to pay your bills for the next 5 years. Even if this account never comes back, we have discretionary expenses, if we needed to, that we could start curtailing. I often recommend a deep cleansing breath, maybe even a yoga class, and we get through it. And just hearing somebody who's lived through it and has is professionally trained to make investment decisions say that, for a lot of people, is enough for them to back away from their PIN number and avoid making the switch. I will tell you, though, out of all the people we talk to, you know, Rick, my husband Rick and I have been doing this for a long time, so we had a lot of phone calls. Of all the people we talked to, two people weren't able to just take the advice, internalize it, and feel better. And so there's a strategy with those people. Then you start talking through, all right, how much do we have to get out of the market? Does it all have to come out? No, not all of it, because it's a realized loss at that point. I mean, you definitely, you might be able to sleep at night over the short term, but long term, this is going to cost you. And so you come to a compromise there. And then once it's out of the market, there's one more step. When do we get back in? Right? So you come up with sort of we can't wait till we're all singing happy days are here again. We know that the right day to buy is when the prices are low, and that usually feels difficult, but have a little strategy. If you are moving money that should be invested, you're not spending this anytime soon. If you're moving it out of the market to feel better, you have to have a strategy for buying back in.
Well, we got a strategy for taking good emails. This is a very good email. I'm not making this up. It came about 35 minutes ago. Shouldn't I be more defensive in my TSP since the market is near all-time highs and most companies' earnings don't justify their exuberant multiples?
I love that question. That was very well written and perfectly timed. So my first question would be, what do you consider to be more defensive? I'm going to assume that being more defensive means moving out of the stock choices, the CS&I funds, and into the G fund, because we don't want bonds right now either. When interest rates are low, interest rates eventually go up, and that bond fund is going to go down. So if that assumption is correct, the only way that will be a successful strategy is if we know when to get back in, right? I agree that the market's pretty high, and I agree that it's hard to understand why. How are companies actually making money? And I agree the market will go down. When? I'm not going to say, because I'm not psychic. I actually don't know that. But I know when the market drops, it eventually bounces off the bottom without calling me and saying, hey, Karen, you got a day and a half to buy at these low prices, and then I'm going to make your head spin with a 60% bounce up. Think about it. We saw this in 2008, right? 2008 was pretty darn ugly for stocks, and then 2009 got even uglier. But somewhere in March, when we were still watching the recession teetering into this could be a depression, we were still seeing more and more people losing jobs than getting jobs, what did the market do? one of its best days in market history. So if you got out for all the right reasons, right, market's high, P.E. ratios are lousy, throw in a crazy election, I can come up with, we can spend the rest of the hour doing that, all the reasons to get out, you have got to know the day to get back in. And we can spend the rest of the year talking about that, and we won't come to the right answer. Even professionals know the right day to buy is behind us. The day you're trying to buy, you don't know. It could still go lower. So, again, it's kind of like what we were talking about before with people calling and being nervous in February and March when the markets were dropping. Are you sure you want to get out? Maybe being defensive, a better way to frame it would be, I'm going to look at my thrift savings plan one more time and just make sure that I don't need any of this money anytime soon. And I would say, if I've always thought of soon within the next 5 years, maybe I'll be more defensive and just say, could I really live my comfortable standard of living without taking money out of my thrift savings plan for another 6 or 7 years, right? What's keeping me from just being the long-term investor who will have to take the market down but be fully invested so you get the full exuberant bounce off the bottom that comes in a way that we just can't time it. The other thing to remember is if you're still working, you're buying. So the market drops, you get to buy all of that on sale. Different, clearly, if we're retired. But if we're retired and still in the thrift plan, we probably have a lot more money in that G fund than somebody who moved their money to an IRA and has a wider variety of investments that can be more defensive, right? We can have more moderate investment choices in an IRA than we can with the thrift plan. Thrift plan, you're either on the roller coaster in an index stock fund or you're sitting in cash.
Wow. Megan, question. Do you get the same chatter, calls, et cetera, in this period of exuberance? And now people are more concerned about their estate planning than what they were before?
Absolutely. There is nothing like a good pandemic to encourage people to consider their own mortality.
That's a great line.
Business is definitely picked up for estate planners. A lot of people are thinking about what happens to my loved ones, what happens to my things, who's in charge if I can no longer make decisions for myself. But one thing I really want to bring up in this topic of retirement plans is beneficiary designations. Anytime we're talking about retirement plans, we really, really, really want to think about, who do I have named on my beneficiary designation? When I start working with an employer and you sign up for the benefits through your employer and they give you a piece of paper, you know, in my case, I started working for my first employer when I was in my 20s. I wasn't married and I named my sister as my beneficiary of my retirement plan. Fast forward, I get married and anytime my life circumstances change, I need to make sure I'm updating that form. If I wrote a will even that said, when I die, everything goes to my spouse, and then I pass away, but my beneficiary designation form still names my sister, that retirement plan will go to my sister and not my spouse, even though I have a will.
Oh, she would give Tom the money. Don't worry, Meg.
Sure, sure. You know, we all like to think everyone plays nice in these situations, but let me tell you, family, if you have any family drama now, you can just multiply that by a million when you've got a little bit of money involved. So we want to make sure we have those updated. Another huge mistake I see when we're talking about our retirement plans is you say, okay, well, yeah, I got married and I updated that and I named my spouse as the primary beneficiary, but if my spouse and I both pass away, then I'm naming the kids as the contingent beneficiary. This is a huge problem, Bob. It really is where so many pitfalls come into play. My son is perfect. He's 18 months old, year and a half, cute as can be, and I'm sure he's going to be a brilliant financial genius someday. However, if I name him directly as the beneficiary of my retirement plan, when he turns 18 or 21 years old, he will get that money outright without any supervision. I don't know how you were making your financial decisions when you were 18 years old. I, for one, was not the most savvy, even coming from a financial planning family. But that's really not a great move for our kids. We want to make sure we have some guidance there. So we want to work with an estate planning attorney to make sure that we're not leaving money outright to our kids.
All right, we're going to take a break here, but if we can come back and then come back to this subject and hear your boots on the ground knowledge as to people's reaction to what you were telling them, was it adverse or did they go, oh? But anyway, let's hear what the good folks at WAPM can do for our listeners.
Life insurance is a conversation worth having. As a civilian federal employee, you have access to exclusive coverage from WAPA, the life insurance choice of over 46,000 feds and their families. With WAPA Group Term Life Insurance, you can apply for up to $1.5 million in portable coverage at a competitive price. Last year, the average fed who switched saved $375. WAPA is a proud sponsor of For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, Mondays 10:05 to 11 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. WAPA has been insuring the future of feds and their families for more than 75 years. To learn more about life insurance for feds by feds, visit WAEPA.org today.
Welcome back to For Your Benefit. We're here with Karen Schaefer, certified financial planner, Megan Schaefer, estate planning attorney. And right at the break, Megan was developing a thought process, but I have to say somewhat tight with the break time. So let's pick up where we left off.
And I want to ask Megan a question. You threw something in there saying that if I just name my kid as my beneficiary, they get the money at 18 or 21. I always thought it was 18 because pretty much every state has 18 as the age of majority. When does 21 factor in?
Right. So if I just name my child and they're currently below the age of 18 on a beneficiary designation, and let's say I pass away, well, no one is going to just hand money over to anyone who's below the age of 18. First, what I'm going to need to do, or not me, I'm the dead one, but someone's going to need to go to court and petition court on behalf of my minor child and say, this money needs to be received for the benefit of this child. So the way we do that is we ask a judge, we say, I'm going to be the person who looks over it, we're going to set up a specialized type of account to take this money. And a lot of times what happens is we might set up what's called an UTMA account, or there's other specialized forms that we can put in place that will hold this money and allow that money to be used for the child's benefit with a little bit of adult supervision. Even in those cases, though, where we have a court setting up and allowing it a type of supervised account to be set up, the oldest they're going to last is till age 21.
Okay.
And even then, remember, we've had to go to court, we've had to pay lawyers, we've already wasted so much of this money. Mm-hmm. The better thing to do is to go to a lawyer and say, I need a will. I have young kids. I want to make sure that if something happens to me, that the money can be used for their benefit, and that they don't get to decide how it's used themselves. That, you know, one of my siblings or a friend that makes good financial decisions can manage this money on their behalf and can spend it for their health and their education and daily living expenses and maybe a vacation every now and then, but that it doesn't get wasted on the brand new shiny car or the cool dirt bike that just came out. So
I actually had a young woman who came into money at 18, and I was trying to explain to her. The court had been involved and had structured it so she would get $40,000 a year until she was 40, and then it would pay out the rest. This was the result of an accident. She had no parental supervision at all with this money. And I said, do you realize what a gift this is? You're going to be able to pay for your college. And she agreed that was very special, but we're only talking by phone, and we didn't really have much opportunity in two conversations to develop much of a trust relationship. Long story short, she took her friends to Ireland for $40,000, and by August, was literally homeless and not going to college.
It's unfortunately a common story.
It just broke my heart. She just didn't know that she was going to be able to change her life arc for the better. And So I'm only telling the story, Bob, because I find that people can't envision their own children being orphaned. It's just too hard emotionally. And so they just stop with the action, I've got to take care of them. So you've got to paint kind of this is what happens in the real world. And now let's just stay on this topic for just another conversation, and the lawyer can get your documents done.
Exactly. And even the smartest among us, none of us have the life experience by 21 years old to know how we're going to need money and what our options are and the best way to spend to invest and save. And so naming someone else to be in charge of that on behalf of our children is really the best way to go. And so just coming full circle with this, bringing this back to our beneficiary designations, what we want is a will that says when I pass away, you know, everything goes to my spouse, and then if my spouse also dies, everything goes to a trust for my children. I then go back to my beneficiary designation forms that are on all of my retirement accounts and my life insurance if I have any, and I complete those to say, this goes to my wife, but if my wife passes away, then it goes to the trust for my children. I don't put my children's name directly. I put the trust that I've set up for them under my will.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned You mentioned something called an UGMA, Megan. I think it may be even before the break. What is an UGMA?
There's a uniform transfer to minors account, and it allows for money to be held for someone who's under the age of majority or who is under the age of 21 years, and it's money set aside in their name. It's an own asset in their name, and
it becomes theirs at the age of majority. You know, Bob, that's what we used to use, as you remember, all the time as a choice on how to save for college. Because once we created this account, there was still a little adult supervision, but the child's tax bracket. So that was better for saving for college than saving in the parent's higher tax bracket. Well, then we got that kiddie tax law. When was that? I don't know, 87 or something. It just became less and less attractive as a tax minimizing strategy. And then, of course, as the kids get older, you start realizing, wait a minute, 18 is not the age of reason. So fortunately, we got much better ways to set aside money for college in those code section 529 plans. And we just skipped using them. They still exist, and the court can still set it up as a little bridge between when a minor gets the money, if they're left money when somebody dies. But we don't really, I can't remember the last time we recommended it. It's still a consequence that's out there, but we don't use them.
That's what I thought. Okay, good.
Yeah. But the court could use it. You know, it's better than nothing, right?
You got it.
Yeah.
So when you talk about money and this was one of your bullet points. How do you talk about money up and down the family tree? So does everybody get to participate or listen to where the documents are saying the money goes upon passing?
Well, you know, and this is a phrase that I actually picked up from Megan, where I always used to say it's one thing to get estate planning documents done. Remember, estate planning would be a cornerstone piece of your personal financial plan. But it's another thing to have the appropriate conversations. And what it really amounts to is age-appropriate conversations up and down the family tree. And I always had the lens, the fairness lens. It's not fair to my young children for them to worry what happens to mom and dad. I need to just tell them, you know, you'd live with Auntie Colleen at an age where they're going, okay, and what's for supper, right? And then when they start to have their own questions, I can have answers because I've done documents. But I think the same way, up the family tree. it's unrealistic for me to just assume I know what my parents want if they need a little bit of care. It shouldn't be my, it'd be easier for me if I just sold their home in Michigan and moved them in with me. I should have that conversation, and I should see what's important to them. But also, now that I'm kind of the senior generation, I need to expect my adult children to know the method to my madness. It's not enough for me to just say, you know, call Bob if you need any tax advice. I have to say, and here are my PIN numbers, and this is the scope of my balance sheet. Maybe not with numbers as their young adults, but certainly with numbers and passwords as their adult professionals who at any day, I could be the one with the COVID. We have the horror stories of people being on ventilators and the family just not even being able to make the mortgage payment because they don't know how to do it.
And I will say that the conversations to have with adult children are essential. We may have written the documents that say, if I can't communicate with my doctors, then my son or daughter can. And we might say, okay, well, if anything happens to me, they'll take care of me. But have you given them the practical tools to be able to do that? And by that I mean, do they know where you do your banking? If you say, well, you know, I've given them the authority where they can use my assets to pay for my medical care, if they're spending a month just figuring out which bank you use, that's a huge problem. So I make the recommendation to sit down with your adult children, tell them who your advisors are, where you do your banking, make a list of all of your assets. It does not need to be PIN numbers and account numbers, but I need to know that you have a life insurance policy with this company. It's so amazing to me how quickly credit card companies will figure out that we've died. It's like they find out before the mortician has found out. But our life insurance companies, they're not calling out our families and say, oh, by the way, Megan had $1 million policy with us. We can't wait to pay it out.
Right. And it really is surprising to me. This has happened my entire career when I ask people, before I can answer any of your good financial planning questions, I need to know your personal goals, your balance sheet, and your cash flow. And, you know, just basic financial data. And it's astounding how often people list their assets and forget something, right? It's often the savings bonds that they bought when their supervisor was the bond chairperson, or that first little savings account. You know, I remember Rick and I started putting $25 a month into a little growth mutual fund when our oldest was born. And it's one of those automatic. I think we put $100 a month into it now. It was the way we were going to save for college. It is so not on my radar screen, but $100 a month is still going into it. It could be very meaningful money. Rick and I never talk about it, it's just an automatic little investment. Our kids know we have retirement accounts. If they didn't know to go looking for that, oh, and by the way, there's this little one-off, very unusual for us to have account, it would be squandered. So the pull the balance sheet together, whether you have estate planning documents that need to be drafted or updated, is an exercise that any good financial plan that's going to stay on track goes through annually. And, you know, I recommend that people do this around tax time. Don't take this personally, Bob, but people are usually irritable around tax time.
Oh, I've never noticed that.
No, yeah. So I always say, if you're a little irritable anyway, and all the data for getting your is spread across your desk because you're trying to do this with your TurboTax, or you just got the packet back from your tax preparer, and they with the sign here, just set aside another hour. All the data's right there, and please update your goals, balance sheet, cash flow. It'll fix a drink if you need to, your choice, and just make sure you are holding yourself to that standard so that somebody could come in and find this data if they needed to, or once your children are of the right age, you can be sharing that information. See, we just did our little update. This is the format we're using, and now let's get back to life. An hour a year is workable for most of us.
Okay, so
I like to call it the... Yep, go ahead, Bob.
So what's a balance sheet?
Or an unbalanced sheet. Yeah, so it's simply that list of what you own versus what you owe. But I like to see a reasonable amount of data. Instead of just saying, you know, I've got my checking and savings account, my thrift savings plan, my house, my car, I want somebody to know I've got operating accounts at this bank, and I've got a thrift savings plan that's traditional versus Roth and invested this way, and I want the IRA custodian to be kind of spelled out and how it's invested. The house, I want a value on that, right? I want to know what these things are worth. Not to the level of detail where I'm asking an appraiser to charge me $500 and give me their professional opinion, but I want to look at what comparables are going for, or have the free conversation with the realtor in my neighborhood who's pretty spot on. And in doing that kind of list each and every year, it makes it much more difficult for me to forget or to kind of double count or over or underestimate something that I own. But of course, let's not forget what we owe. You know, financial planning questions are often, should I be paying off my student loans, or should I be putting more money in thrift? Should I be helping my brother who runs a restaurant that's really being hit by the COVID close downs all over the place, or should I be paying more on my mortgage because I'm trying to retire? I don't know is the answer to those kinds of questions when you have choices about where to direct money, to debt or to building assets or to helping solve a problem, until we know the interest rate, until we know whether it's a variable rate, until we know the scope of the loan. If it's just going to be money that we can pay back in a couple of years, boy, I treat that really differently than, are you kidding me? If you take that kind of loan, or if you help a family member to that extent, you do realize you will not be putting much more than 5% into your thrift savings plan for the next 10 years. 10 years is too long. You, the strong person in the family tree financially, now becomes a weak link as well. And that's how the plan crumbles and gets pulled off track during this crisis.
Wow. Megan, I have to ask a question. How many people come into your office if you haven't already provided them with a blank balance sheet? Do they come in? Do they even understand? I think people would understand that balance. Well, that's my house. Money in the thrift.
Come into her Zoom call.
Yep, they're showing up to the Zoom calls these days. How many? Well, I do ask that clients show up with knowledge of two things. One is what they own, and two is what their family is. And that's about it. But there are, even with that, a lot of people that show up and they just, you know, they haven't gotten to it, they haven't written anything together, and that's how we spend our first 20 minutes, is we pull together what they have in their head of everything they own and where it is, and then that's their homework I send them home with, is flesh this out and you know, make sure it's accurate. And, you know, if you want to spend money paying a lawyer to sit around with you for 20 minutes, there are a lot of people that are happy to take that time. But if you want to save a little money doing that homework before your first meeting and pulling together a list of your assets is a great way to just save a few bucks.
Okay, good.
But, you know, Megan, I find that second part, know your family, is what really slows people down, because it's so painful to realize your children weren't created equally, or that you're estranged from a family member that could be the solution to some of the trustees or that sort of thing.
Right. And I notice I didn't say understand your family or have all the solutions for your family. I just said know your family. Be willing to bring your dirty laundry to the table. The sooner you can tell me where the problem areas are, who are the people that you're worried about, it's my job to figure out how to solve those problems, not yours. So if you're trying to figure out, well, you know, I know we need to name a guardian for the kids, or I know we're going to need to set aside money for mom and dad, or I know we need to do this or that, I just don't know how to do it. If that's what's standing in your way of moving forward with your estate plan, just ignore that altogether. That's what the professionals are for. We figure out the problems. We help you solve your issues based on what we have to work with. So we can sort that out. You just need to know that there are problems.
And be willing to talk about it.
Exactly.
All right. Why don't we all take a break for just a minute or so and listen to what NITP can do for the listeners.
Who do you trust when making your most important decisions? National Institute of Transition Planning has been the trusted source for federal retirement planning, serving new, mid-career, and pre-retirement federal employees for more than 30 years. NITP's subject matter experts bring more than 800 years of collective expertise on federal benefits, financial, transition, and estate planning. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com to sign up for their free monthly newsletter and information about free webinars.
Does planning for retirement seem like a daunting task? Is retirement years away? It will arrive sooner than you think. Prepare now to stay on track. Join the thousands of federal employees and retirees who have already attended National Institute of Transition Planning's free monthly webinars to learn more about retirement and financial planning. NITP is the national leader and trusted source for federal retirement information. Visit NITPinc.com to sign up for NITP's free monthly newsletter and webinar.
Welcome back to For Your Benefit. We're here today, the final leg of the show, with Karen Schaefer, certified financial planner, Megan Schaefer, estate planning attorney, and they've imparted such good information. I promise you, I'm not making this up. Many, many years ago, I used to make up emails. Then I don't have to do it anymore. Here it comes. I never married and don't have children. I'm worth more than $1 million, but don't have a will. What happens to my assets when I pass? How much will it cost me to get a will? When is it best time to get one since I've almost passed away a few months ago?
So the best time to get a will for you then is immediately. And the question about cost is one that comes up all the time, and it's going to depend on who you work with and where you live. You know, certainly any time we go right into the middle of the big city, those attorneys are going to cost more than if we drive out to the suburbs a little bit. And prices vary widely, both geographically, but also in terms of what type of plan you need. If you walk into my office and say, I'm single and I just want everything to go to my alma mater or my favorite niece or nephew, that's a much simpler plan than I want to set up these three foundations and, you know, I plan for these, you know, 27 other contingencies. So it's really going to vary. Any attorney, though, after your first meeting, you'll meet for about an hour, you'll talk about your finances and your family and your particular situation, they should be able to give you a pretty good ballpark estimate, and then you'll be able to know whether or not that's a price you feel comfortable paying and moving forward. Also, if you do have cost concerns, bring that up the earlier the better, and that's something that your attorney can be aware of. The other part of that is your question was, where does my money go? I don't have a will. Well, every state has laws that say where does money go when someone passes away without them, and they vary widely by state. You mentioned in the email that unmarried, no kids, and so likely the next place would be to parents, if parents are still living. If not parents, then siblings. If not siblings, nieces and nephews, and so on and so forth around the family tree. I do want to mention, though, that states really do differ on whether or not 100% of assets go to a surviving spouse if someone dies without a will. If, for example, I live in Virginia and I have a spouse and kids, I pass away, 100% of my assets will go to my spouse, even if I don't have a will. If, however, I move across the border and I live in D.C. or Maryland, those states have different laws. A portion of my money would go to my kids and a portion would go to my spouse. So it really depends on where we're living. And again, we don't want to go just by the laws anyway. We want to make sure we have a will in place is the important part there. In your case, what I would be concerned about, though, is what are we going to do in case of incapacity? Mm-hmm. And who is the best friend, who's the sibling that's going to step up and know that it's time to start making some important decisions for you? What kind of relationship do you have with them now? And if you don't have that person in place, let's start working with a professional or building that relationship now, because it's one thing when we have our kids coming into our house and say, hey, Mom, did you remember to pay the electricity bill this month? The lights won't turn on. It's another thing when we don't have kids, we don't have someone of that younger generation that is comfortable enough coming to us and saying, you know what, Megan, I don't think you're making responsible decisions anymore, and I think it's time for someone else to step in.
And I think also, Megan, that planning for incapacity, part of estate planning, gets underscored and all cap and bold when somebody really is single, right? And single by definition of law. You can be single and have a partner, but that partner doesn't have any automatic rights if that partner's not your spouse. So it's really important. As a financial planner, I'm always more concerned about what happens when my client is incapacitated to the point they can't or shouldn't be making decisions, right, than when they die. Because even, you know, that it's often a waste of time and money to handle an estate that didn't have good estate planning or any estate planning documents, at least we know what to do. We go to the court, the laws are there, we follow what we have to do. But when somebody doesn't have their plan for their own incapacity, we go to the court, and the court, who's never met you, never met any of your family members, doesn't know the crazies from the not-so-crazies, doesn't know your best friend, often either the wrong person from the family tree gets plucked to make these decisions, or a professional who can bill in the Washington, D.C. area here, $300 to $500 an hour to do the kinds of things that your best friend would have been honored to do for you. And, oh, by the way, you would be willing to do for them. So that whole planning for incapacity thing is really the first thing that my brain was screaming when Bob was reading out your question. Yeah, we got to make sure that there is clarity here. And it requires the same conversation as well. It's the documents and the good conversation. But there's one other thing, Megan, I just wanted to make sure that we make clear right now in the pandemic. We are not meeting very many people face-to-face. We are able to do an awful lot of keeping financial plans on track, getting estate plans started, or just keeping them on track with that ever-so-popular Zoom phone call or the FaceTime or the good old-fashioned mail or the auto-signed documents. So we can't even, you know, people who do have compromised health or are just worried about getting out of their own little germ bubble and into somebody else, we have solutions to that. Everybody needs to.
And how do you get that across to, if there are two people, one's probably going to take a different view than the other, but let's say there's one person and they just don't know the questions to ask, or they've asked the questions to anybody else other than a professional, and they come in armed with what they feel is knowledge. That's probably very diplomatic in trying to say, nah, that's not right.
I'd say that's one of the best case scenarios for explaining, you know, why you need a professional to do this work. A lot of times I've heard there's a judge who's the head of the probate courts in Montgomery County, Maryland. He's a great guy, and he speaks regularly to attorneys. And I've heard him say a million times that he'd rather have someone come into his courtroom who's passed away and they've died without a will than with a will that was prepared online. And one of the reasons for that is that people don't know what questions they're missing. People don't know when they're answering questions in their own head in a wrong way, or they think they've got something figured out, but really they've made it more complicated. So that's one of the best cases for working, why we need to work with a professional in these matters.
I had a case years ago where a couple, both of them federal government employees, both of them lawyers for different agencies, and they had drafted their own wills. And Rick is talking to them about their investments, and I'm kind of paging through the will as the certified financial planner who knows estate planning 101. I'm not an estate planning professional. And I just had to stop and interrupt their conversation. Why did you disinherit your kids? I mean, there's a story here that I got it. And they hadn't. And they were horrified. No, we leave it to so-and-so. And I said, not the way this is drafted. They had pulled some template that had every single what if you want to disinherit kids, if you want to leave it in a trust, and they had left it all in there. But the order of the paragraphs, they had disinherited their kids. The classic example of you don't know what you don't know, even if you're very bright and educated in your field. If this is not your field, you need to get work with somebody who has that expertise.
I think the three of us, we each do different things, but we could probably tell stories about meeting with folks that felt that they knew what one of us knows, or two of us knows, or three of us knows. And you have to be very diplomatic to say, no. And they go, well, my brother or sister or my folks said that's accurate. And it's not confrontational, maybe initially, but then they go, oh, that's what you do for a living, isn't it? I go, yeah.
Well, and, you know, I always have to ask who gave you that financial planning advice. You know, one of my favorite questions when I'm teaching a class is, before you take advice from somebody, you just need to slow down and say, what qualifies them to give you the advice? I met a young woman whose financial plan got pulled off track by the pandemic because she asked her boss kind of a question similar to what the email was at the top of the hour, Bob, with shouldn't I be moving my money out of stock into the G fund? She's 28 years old. And her supervisor told her yes. Well, what has the stock market done since March? It's been nothing but up, and she's 28. And she's making good contributions to her thrift savings plan. So she listened to one of the NITP webinars and said, I think I've made a mistake. I thought, you know, when you're 28, any mistake can be fixed. So, but she learned a valuable lesson. Before I take advice, it's one thing to have conversations with people, but you really only want to take advice from people who are qualified to give you the advice.
All right, both of you probably have good boots on the ground experience with this, where whatever you were saying, Megan or Karen, to, let's say, the parents, but the kids are in the room. And then when they get home, the kid in the room says, no, you know, that's not right. This is what you should do. Do you ever face that where the people call you back and say, I'm in a quandary now?
You know what, Bob, that hasn't happened a lot to me. I think I understand conceptually where you're coming from, where an adult child may have too much influence over a parent, and you see it vice versa, actually, where a parent is unduly influencing adult children who should be making their own decisions. But I think that kind of problem gets mitigated sooner rather than later. When somebody starts with the expectation that I understand my own finances and I can do financial planning and hire a professional when I need to, then they have the confidence. But I will share with you every once in a while, we have had to say, no, let's get the whole family together and have the conversation together. It's much easier to either diffuse those situations or avoid them altogether if you're having more of a family meeting facilitated by the expert, the invited expert, than if we're constantly having these splintered conversation. I learned this once, though. There was an attorney who had come to my office to visit with the two sons and about the dad who was already incapacitated and what kind of estate planning they needed. And the brothers were fighting, and the attorney just got up and left the table and said, I'm going to give you a minute. But I can't give you advice on a personal level, but I do know this. Brothers shouldn't fight. And he got up and he left the room.
Wow.
And I was just so impressed by that. And then I realized, I'm still sitting here. I need to get up and leave the room. And I said, that was a pretty good technique. And he goes, look, they're upset. Their dad is in failing mental capacity. They don't want to be doing this, but they have to do it. They'll come around. And, you know, so it's the softer people skills that are a big part of what every professional has to develop to be effective.
Yeah. I have often said that being an estate planning attorney is one part lawyer and one part therapist. I will throw in, for those that are nervous about bringing their dirty laundry to the table, it is also one part daytime talk show host. So don't worry about spilling your secrets. We've heard it all before.
Okay. We got 1 minute left in the show. So final comments?
Well, I would just say, you know, if people are really worried about keeping their financial plan on track during a pandemic, the first thing is to get rid of the tendency to want to do the panic sell and raise your hand to the right person if you've really got some questions. The other is, as all these laws come out, you know, we've got the CARES Act, we have another one, just because the law says you can do something doesn't mean you should do it. And then finally, I will speak for Megan here a little bit. If we've got the time to walk through goals, balance sheet, cash flow for our financial plan, we'll also make the time to walk through what do we own, what's the family all about, and do I have the right kind of documents in place to make sure that if anything happened, if I was the one who got the virus and was on the ventilator, I hope they're just being sad and not having their hair on fire because there's so many unanswered questions, they don't know what to do.
Okay.
Yeah, call the lawyer for the estate plan and pull together your beneficiary designations. Make sure they name the right people and that they don't name minor children.
Very good. You might have a stop clock there. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And thanks, Karen and Megan, for a fantastic show. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP and sponsored by WEPA. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. This show can also be heard on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search For Your Benefit. Thanks for listening.